You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of October, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Paul Osborne. On today's show...
Refugees who are in Turkey to stay in Turkey, that's the first point, which is important. And the second point is preventing refugees and migrants from travelling through Turkey to come to the European Union.
As EU leaders reach an agreement with Turkey to try to ease the refugee crisis, my guests, Peter Fleming and Ramita Navai, will tell us their thoughts on this and the day's other top stories, including...
First, I've decided to maintain our current posture of 9,800 troops in Afghanistan through most of next year, 2016. Their mission will not change. Our troops will continue to pursue those two narrow tasks that I outlined earlier, training Afghan forces and going after Al-Qaeda.
President Barack Obama announcing the American troops will remain in Afghanistan through 2016, breaking his promise to end the U.S. military engagement in the region. Then we'll turn our focus to Iran as the nuclear deal comes into force this weekend. All that plus we'll look at the life and legacy of the former Canadian ambassador to Iran, Ken Taylor. All to come on Midori House with me, Paul Osborne. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today, Peter Fleming, Professor of Business and Society at the Cass Business School, and also the author of The Mythology of Work, among others, and Ramita Navai, a freelance foreign affairs journalist, who's the author of City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death, and the Search for Truth in Tehran. Welcome both of you to the programme. We'll be talking a lot about Tehran a little bit later, but let's start with these latest moves to try to ease Europe's migrant and refugee crisis. Now, EU states insist they've reached agreement with Turkey on a new plan, which it's hoped will slow the movement of migrants through the country. Turkey, it seems, isn't so sure. Since the start of this year, almost 600,000 people have reached EU territory by sea, and many of them have travelled through Turkey. Now, under the terms of the apparent deal, if Turkey does more to stop or at least slow that movement, it could unlock up to €3 billion in aid, an easing of visa restrictions on Turkish people travelling across Europe, and, maybe, revive talks on the country joining the EU. Ramita, let me start with you. Turkey's foreign minister has said today that this deal is only a draft. Now, the financial incentives, €3 billion, are nowhere near good enough. Now, the EU leaders are putting it about yesterday. They'd done a deal, and it doesn't sound like the Turkish are convinced.
I think they're very far off from a deal. So the actual amount that's being bandied about in real terms is €500 million. So very far off the, as you said, at least €3 billion that Turkey is demanding it gets in aid if it's to come on board. Also, we mustn't forget that at the moment, the international community is not too fond of Turkey. Turkey is not the favourite country with the international community at the moment. And that's got a lot to do with what's happening in the Middle East and the fight against Islamic State. So we know that Turkey has launched a bombing campaign. But of course, it turns out that most of its bombing campaign has been targeted against Kurdish militants in Iraq and in Turkey, and not ISIS. And of course, the Kurds are allies with America, fighting shoulder to shoulder with the Americans against ISIS. So it's looking pretty awkward.
Peter, one of the things they're holding out is an inducement to do what they're asking, to cut the number of refugees reaching the EU, is we could revive the talks on you joining the EU. Now, this has been going on for years. There have been all sorts of things in the way of it. And you would think at a time when there is an argument about the campaign against Islamic State, when Turkey shot down a drone today, at the time when the Russians are intervening and being warned not to get into Turkish airspace, this is not the point at which you would want an EU nation with all of the responsibilities that come with that, right on the borders of Syria.
It seems that, I completely agree, it seems that Turkey's being bought off here a little bit, and it's just yet another example of the EU not really going to the heart of the problem, but trying to, you know, create a stopgap in which you buy off Turkey to take the brunt, to stop the flow of immigrants. And, you know, it makes me wonder why Turkey would want to be part of the EU at the moment, given the economic mess it is in. And I don't think, you know, the debates around Turkey joining the EU and the, Ramita said, the kind of contentious role that Turkey has within relation to the EU, human rights issues in particular. Ironically enough, when I was living in Australia, it was Kurdish refugees from Turkey that were arriving in Australia. So the antecedents of this deal today seem to outweigh the benefits that we can see deriving from it. And I can see why Turkey is pretty contentious and very cautious about, you know, announcing a deal at this stage.
It's not clear exactly what Turkey is being expected to do here. It's clear what they're being offered. They're being offered financial inducements. It'll be easier for people to travel in the EU without getting visas necessarily. There's this possibility of EU talks. But what exactly is it that they want Turkey to do? Is it just, why don't you hang on to more of the migrants? Because as Tayyip Erdogan has said today, we've already got 2.5 million people who've crossed into Turkey.
I think you're right. I think the plan is to stem the flow, I'm using words bandied around in the media now, of refugees. And that means to stop Syrians leaving Turkey in the first place, mostly Syrians. And of course, 70%, we now know that over 70%, most of the refugees coming to Europe are coming, as you said, across this eastern land route. So Turkey, across the Mediterranean, Greece, into Europe. And it's also a good question, what can Turkey do anyway? Well, they can patrol that coast, but it's, you know, it's a porous border. Turkey's got a very long border with many countries. It's a really porous border. It's really hard to patrol. That coast is the first place that they should concentrate their efforts on. That coast at the moment is completely overrun by smugglers and is in, really, as it, the smugglers are in charge of that passage of water at the moment.
Turkey's talked about an international buffer zone, a safe zone in northern Syria, rather than people crossing into Turkey, that the international community would enforce this safe zone. Again, that it seems unlikely that they're going to go for that, countries like America, countries like EU countries, when they're already worried enough about Russian planes being in the sky and American planes in the sky. They're very unlikely to want to adopt this Turkish idea of a policing a safe zone.
It's too complex and it's too dangerous to even think about building a safe zone that is then, you know, controlled by whom. And sooner or later, the Russian fighter jets are going to be testing that safe zone. A little bit like the drone and the that was shot down, that was potentially a Russian drone, and the fighter jets last week that crossed into Turkish airspace. It would just be too sensitive, especially now that Russia has come through as a major player, kind of out of nowhere in some regards, in this whole conflict, in this whole situation, which I think has put the US on a bit of a back foot.
Angela Merkel is due in Turkey over the weekend. She's due to have talks with Mr. Erdogan. You would think, 2 weeks away from an election, this is a chance of a big diplomatic coup. You've got the most powerful leader in Europe has come to your country for talks. You look like a big player on the world stage. Firstly, there is clearly a massive difference of opinion between Mr. Erdogan and Frau Merkel on whether they have a deal or not. And secondly, how does he approach this with that election coming? Does he look like he's happy to do what the EU wants? Or does he want to look like a strong leader who stands up to them?
Well, I think he's in a pretty good position. He's looking good, even if no deal has been reached. He has the European Commission and Angela Merkel discussing giving hundreds of millions, if not billions, of aid to Turkey. And we mustn't forget, you know, Turkey's dealing with over 2 million refugees. You know, that's crippling for any economy. And it's not getting aid. It's getting very little help. So he's looking at a cash injection. He's looking at what Turkey has wanted for so long, open talks again about renegotiating Turkey becoming part of the EU. So I think he is looking in a good position. And in fact, there are many of his detractors are complaining that this is playing right into Erdogan's hands 2 weeks before an election.
Peter, what do you think about that? Do you think he's played this well?
I think he's played it very well. Merkel is losing a lot of goodwill in Germany at the moment, and the euphoria of the moral coup that she quite rightly won when she welcomed, now it's coming up to 800,000 immigrants, you know, this is a large number. That euphoria is wearing off very, very quickly, and she is desperate now to kind of capitalise on that moral moral coup that is now looking in jeopardy. So I think I'm not too sure if it's intentional, and I'm not too sure if there's any kind of ultra strategic instrumentalism involved, but it seems to be the way in which the cards have been dealt, you know, that he is in quite a strong position.
Well, we'll see how that goes over the weekend. Well, let's turn our attention now, though, to Afghanistan. Now, Barack Obama was elected on a promise to end America's military engagements in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, now he's had to admit that American forces will have to stay in Afghanistan beyond the end of his second term. Mr. Obama says a continued presence is vital to U.S. security. So just under 10,000 troops are going to stay in Afghanistan through 2016. And that number could be halved early in 2017 if conditions on the ground improve. And as we know, that is quite a big if. Peter, let me start with you. President Obama was elected in 2008 on a promise to, in his words, responsibly end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, the full-on campaigns in both countries have ended, but there are US troops in Iraq overseeing the fight against Islamic State there. We now know there are going to be 10,000 staying in Afghanistan. There may well be that many still there when he leaves office. There's a lesson here for whoever succeeds him, which is only make very, very modest promises that you're absolutely certain you can deliver on.
Definitely. And I suspect that Obama genuinely thought back then that he could achieve those goals. But things have become more complex, as they tend to do. You know, this is about Russia as much as anything else. So there has to be a big, you know, ISIS and the Taliban. The Taliban have made a major resurgence back in Afghanistan. But with the introduction of Russia into the mix, there's nothing that Obama can do but continue to have a presence there. So it could be seen as a U-turn, but you can see that the events have unfolded, which have put him in a difficult position. Also, one must remember that the Democratic campaign at the moment is very important. So you have Hillary Clinton, who's always been very pro-presence within that area. And if he wants to look like he's consistent with her as a front-runner in that election, then he's going to have to make sure that what he says now is consistent when the election debates begin.
Well, I was wondering how this would impact on the debate leading up to 2016. Because there's another way of saying this is actually not very helpful for Hillary Clinton, because she was a part of the Obama administration that promised to end the war in Afghanistan. She is seeking effectively to continue Democratic administration in the White House, taking over from a president who failed to deliver on that promise.
And let us not forget, failed in his promise, a major presidential promise, to close Guantanamo, still open.
Good point.
I think what this shows is a real naivety when it comes to foreign policy. I think that's what Obama's government has shown, because this is foreign policy based on what they hope for, not based on what is practical. And, you know, I think what's happening in Afghanistan is really interesting, and it comes as no surprise to Afghans or to anybody who's been covering Afghanistan. So both times that I've covered it, I've been there, 2005 and 2010, talking to Afghans there. The first thing they said when you discussed US presence and US troops and withdrawal was, the minute that the US withdraw from here, the Taliban are going to come in. And of course, that's exactly what's happened. And we mustn't forget as well, so there's Kunduz, which is the major win for the Taliban since the war began. So they managed to take Kunduz for 2 weeks before they retreated. There's also Helmand. So there's been fierce fighting in Helmand for months and months now, and this is really underreported. And death rates, civilian and fighters, been the highest since the war. And I think there was a really interesting UN report that said that the Taliban are more widely spread throughout the country now than at any time since 2001.
And in Ashraf Ghani, you have another Afghan president who effectively can only hang on to office for as long as there are American troops there to make sure he stays in office.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I think with Ashraf Ghani, the major difference with him and Karzai is that he welcomes troops. He's much more of a pragmatist, and it's about fixing the country. And he is asking the Americans, he has been asking the Americans not to pull out. So I think the timing is certainly right with regards to Ghani. But, I mean, this was going to happen.
From the perspective, Peter, of how you sell this to
the American population, who are quite war-weary to begin with. You've said you went into Iraq to stabilize Iraq, you pulled out, and now half of the country's in the hands of Islamist militants. You went into Afghanistan to stabilize Afghanistan, you fought the Taliban for 14 years, you pulled out, the Taliban just came back. How does a future American president persuade the population that it's worth being a player on the world stage? Because it never seems to work very well.
It certainly doesn't, and it's turning into a miniature and maybe swiftly a major kind of duplicate of the Vietnam War. And people are drawing that parallel on the ground in the United States quite a lot at the moment. But you have to remember, we're coming up to an election, and elections in the US tend to be very, very, very warmongering. And there's the American public moves into a different frame of mind, in which suddenly patriotism and all of those kind of costs of real war in the Middle East that's cost billions, if not trillions, of dollars, suddenly gets forgotten as the propaganda machine starts to. So what I'm worried about is that cold, sober kind of wariness among the US public is going to be lost as a fever pitch of the election kind of comes up, and all of the war kind of light language, and Hillary Clinton is already doing it, begins to kind of take over and kind of cloud everyday judgment.
It's fascinating to, we keep coming back to Afghanistan, and I'm not going to ask the world's stupidest question, how does this end? Because I'm sure that we can't solve it any more than anybody else can. So we'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, with me, Paul Osborne, with Peter Fleming and Ramita Navai, my guests. Now, coming up in just a moment, Iran's nuclear deal will come into effect this Sunday. Plus, we'll take a look at the life and legacy of Ken Taylor. So do stay tuned.
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all-pressed coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Paul Osborne. Still with me, Peter Fleming and Ramita Navai. We're going to move on to Iran now. Now, it took many long months and a great deal of brickmanship to come to a deal with Tehran on its nuclear program. But this Sunday is when it officially comes into force. Now, under the plan, Iran is to scale back its nuclear activities. In return, world powers will ease economic sanctions. Now, while on the surface this is a cause for celebration, there remain a great many unanswered questions. Ramita, let me start with you. As we said at the beginning, you're the author of a book about the search for, among many things, truth in Tehran. One of the things that hasn't been established here is how this deal is going to be enforced, how the compliance of the Iranian regime is going to be monitored. So the IAEA expects a complete inventory of its nuclear hardware. How confident are we that that's going to be complete?
Well, what we know is that part of the deal, Iran agreed to snap inspections and agreed to the most stringent inspections ever to be enforced on a nuclear program in the world. And you're right, how is this going to be done? Well, the first stage is now that the deal's been ratified by the Guardian Council, so that's a body of 12 clerics and jurists who ratify law in Iran and who vet candidates during elections. So they've okayed it. So that's the first step. The second step, now they've okayed it, is that the IAEA, the Atomic Nuclear Agency, will go in and dismantle thousands of centrifuges, as per the agreement. They'll also help redesign a light water reactor, as opposed to the heavy water reactor that they've got that's capable of making serious nuclear weaponry. That's going to be the first stage. how it's going to pan out and how they're going to agree to monitoring, to step-by-step inspections, that's yet to be seen. And this tells us how tricky negotiations have been. I mean, they started in 2003. It's been 12 years to reach this point now.
And one of the things, Peter, about this is that having got to this point, the deal comes into force, a huge diplomatic success, but as we've just heard, a lot of things that haven't really been resolved. When we hit the first stumbling block, when the IAEA asks for some information, doesn't feel that Iran's giving it that information, if it feels that Iran's holding something back, there's going to be pressure, isn't there, on all sides not to do anything that could cause this to unravel. If the IAEA sounds an alarm and says, they're not cooperating, they're not giving us the information we need, it would be very easy to pull the plug on the whole thing. And that's the last thing that the world powers want as much as Iran.
Definitely. I think this is a classic case of the devil being in the detail here, because I think that the wider view is one that we should welcome. But the monitoring in particular could easily slip into creating a sense of paranoia within Iran that I think that could become dangerous. But also, we must remember that the ballistic missile program is kind of is running ahead at a galloping pace that I guess is making Israel nervous, because they're worried about missiles, ballistic missiles more generally, not only the nuclear ones. So whether the monitoring and the deal kind of tries to curb the arming of other parts of the military in Iran, it would be interesting to see pan out as well.
And of course, as much as those world powers will be keen to say this is working, it's not perfect, but we're getting there, and play down any disagreements, we know that the slightest sign of any indication that Iran isn't complying, and Israel is going to loudly proclaim the deal is dead.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on what Peter said, actually. It is interesting that Iran's already in hot water because they did test this ballistic missile last Sunday. And Samantha Power, the US ambassador to the UN, has already, of course, spoken out and said this is against UN convention. So before the deal has even properly begun, Iran's
in hot water.
And clearly
that's not an accident. That's not a timing coincidence.
No, absolutely not. This is the hardliners posturing. So the hardliners in Iran, they did not want this deal to go ahead. So it's partly posturing from the hardliners, first of all, sending out a message to the people, we are not weak, don't worry, sending out a message to its core supporters, and also sending out a message to the reformists, you better be careful because we're the people in power, look what we're doing. So interestingly, at the same time as the ballistic missile is fired, and they've also given a tour of their underground facility, and it looks very James Bondish. There have been mass arrests recently of artists in Iran in the last few days. A couple of poets, I think 2 days ago, were given 10 years and 99 lashes. About that, they were sentenced for very anodyne poems, kind of social commentary. So there is a lot of posturing going on. However, having said that, it is not in Iran's interest to renege on this deal. It's not in Iran's interest to break this deal so soon. So really what they want is an easing of sanctions. And sanctions, especially EU banking sanctions, is partly what brought them to the negotiating table with such, I was going to say with such ease, not with ease at all.
Eventually. So effectively, the hardliners acting up, what they're doing is, this is sort of a slightly odd analogy, but it's a bit like a teenager who knows they've got to clean their room if they're going to get their new computer, but they complain about it an awful lot along the way. So they're making a lot of noise. They're reminding you that, you know, they're not America's best friend, but actually they, when push comes to shove, they'll do what they need to do to keep the deal going.
Yes, I mean, this is internal power politics. So the hardliners are not too dissimilar from the hawks in America. So, you know, the hawks in America make a lot of noise, and some of that noise is filtered out. So this is the same. And the hardliners were making these noises during the negotiations. So Obama's administration also learned to filter out some of this noise. So it's internal power politics at play here. But I still believe that it is not in Iran's interest. Iran wants to come in from the cold. They want money injected into the country. They need money injected into the country.
Well, finally, for this edition of Midori House, we're going to stay in Iran, but we're going to talk a little bit about Ken Taylor. He was the former Canadian ambassador to Iran, but played a key role in the hostage crisis of 1979. Well, Ken Taylor has died at the age of 81. He sheltered Americans at his ambassadorial residence in Tehran for 3 months. While they were there, he arranged plane tickets for their escape. He persuaded Canada's government to issue fake passports. Now, you may remember some of this if you saw the film Argo a few years ago, which won the Oscar for Best Picture. His actions were somewhat controversially featured in that film. Peter, it's interesting that 2 days before we enter this new dawn of relations with Iran, in which everyone's friends, we all march together to dismantle the centrifuges, it's not that long ago that we had Americans being held hostage and Canadians having to arrange fake passports to smuggle them out.
Definitely, definitely. And by the way, that movie gave such a patriotic view of America that it was actually difficult for many of us to get to the end of the film. But that's another story. Yes, you know, there's a difficult history there. And also, you know, the Iran-Contra scandal that was soon after 1979. It's been a difficult period, and following the revolution, I'm quite interested in the way in which the scandal or the hostage situation kind of unfolded, because the Shah of Iran was seen as a very friendly person for the Western powers, but he had quite a bit of a bad reputation internally. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, he certainly did. Mm. And he is the reason that the revolution began in the first place. And of course, the hostage crisis, I would say one of the most important factors, one of the most important knock-on effects that the hostage crisis did have was to stamp out any of the secular leaders, any of the secular protests. And that really was when it was hijacked by the Islamists. But it's interesting, while we're on this subject, the ex-ambassador, the British ambassador, Sir John Graham, was interviewed recently, and he actually quoted Argo. And he said that he spotted a mistake in Argo, where the Americans said that the Americans who were given refuge by Ken had originally been turned away by the Brits at the British Embassy, and he said that wasn't true.
Well, there's a lot about Argo that's controversial, though, isn't there? I mean, Peter, you referred to a lot of people have trouble finishing it. There was a lot of anger in the film that effectively it presents Ken Taylor as just this bystander who's in the room while the CIA are doing all the donkey work to get these people out and doing all the heroics. And it was actually premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, which is not the place to play down someone who the Prime Minister at the time of the hostage crisis called a true Canadian hero.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And it's difficult to have anything, have a bad word to say about this character, because he is a national hero at the moment. And if you read the articles and the online comments, you know, it's almost like he was someone who was during the Holocaust, you know, saving stranded Jewish people. So it's very, very difficult to kind of give a bit more of a, not cynical, but more of a realistic kind of geopolitical reading of his part in quite a messy period of US-Iran relations. But it was an interesting way in which to premiere the movie, definitely.
Well, Peter, you said you struggled to get to the end of Argo. Ramita, did you get to the end of Argo?
I did. And do you know what? I loved it. But I took it with a pinch of salt. You know, it's Hollywood. There were so many mistakes in it. Lots of my Iranian friends were completely irate, but I wasn't. And I watched with my mum, actually, and she said that a lot of the scenes reminded her, because we were there when the revolution happened, of how it played out, of what it felt like in the streets.
I have a terrible admission to make, which is that I have the DVD of Argo on a shelf at home on one of my shelves of movies marked Must Watch One Day. And to be honest, you've not absolutely convinced me to put it at the top of the pile. There is apparently a documentary which was shown at the Toronto Film Festival the following year, which is all about Ken Taylor, called Our Man in Tehran, which is apparently a much more honest appraisal of him. But we'll have to leave it there. Peter Fleming, Ramita Navai, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. That's all we have time for today. The programme was produced by Colotta Ribello. It was researched by Henry Reece Sheridan and Antonia Metzhauser. Our studio manager, Chris Chilvers, who is hopping in here in just a moment to keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. At 1900, Marcus Hippie will be here for the menu. I'll be back at 2200
with Fionnuala Sweeney for today's Monocle Daily. Midori House returns Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition of the programme, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.